All right. I wish I had some kind of like wacky DJ greeting that I always did for each one of these so people knew that the podcast had started, but this is how the podcast starts.
Well, it normally just starts with us making a lot of giggly noises.
Right. Usually it's
Right.
we're caught mid-giggle. But today we have a guest. We have Jay Finelli with us, and Jay really holds his giggles back and doesn't like to dole them out very wantonly.
I
Jay,
do. I do. Yeah, I don't think anything is funny.
want you to make it work for you.
Excellent.
So I thought I would do a brief introduction just so that Richard's properly introduced to Jay, but also our ones of listeners and tens of listeners get properly introduced to Jay as well. Hi, Mom. And then we'll start from there. So I think it's safe to say that as kids, when Jay and I were kids, our father wanted him to not get involved in the family business. It was more for me and Fredo to run, move the family out to Vegas, wanted Jay to be, like a senator or like a congressman, like always wanted to kind of protect him from the family business. So, I think where we wind up today has been quite a journey. I'm kidding, of course. Of course, Jay is not. So everyone knows Jay and I
You
were.
and I both have Italian American stereotypes as
You
fathers.
do. We were both born in a patch of cheesesteaks at Jim's on South Street, like a little cabbage patch, born there and raised. But no. So, I of course. So, Jay and I go way back. Jay and I have been friends since we met at South by Southwest, as people
I
used
guess. I don't
to.
even know, man. I don't even
People used
know
to meet at South by Southwest. We met at
how that.
South
Yeah.
by
In person.
in person. Jay was friends with a colleague of mine who has the best name in the business still, Chris Cash Dollar. Jay's a former Pittsburgh, is a fellow Pittsburgh native like Chris was from Mars, PA, and introduced us. At that point, Jay was running Full Stop, a web agency that was one of the web agencies, like a design and dev website company making websites when that was like a thing that all of us did at that point. I mean, all of us
What a
did that
time.
at the
What a
same time.
time.
That's the fascinating thing with all these interviews is like at one point, all of us were making websites at the same time. And this is certainly of that era. And then what's cool about Jay is that while he was doing that, he started United Pixel Workers, which was kind of a apparel brand that I felt really tore the rug out from under me with Sillimade because I wanted to do Local 215 t-shirts, and Jay beat me to it by like 3 months. Local 215 was a brilliant.
It was like the story of your life, though.
Our friendship endured, though. The
I was
friendship
so
endured.
so jealous though. I was so like scathingly jealous that he came up with this and did it. Like literally a beat before I did, and just like slammed the card down the table and won the game. But then Pixel Workers kind of became a life of its own, and they shut down Full Stop and started Cotton Bureau, which was a startup built around apparel brands and t-shirts and ordering t-shirts and cool kind of crowdfunded t-shirts and a whole like interesting gamification model for like getting t-shirts off the ground. And then there was a wonderful arc to that that was like stunning to behold, the whole like the explosive growth of it and all the moving parts. Actually, it's interesting. Jay's experience with this was highly impacted by the rise of popularity of podcasts. That was a big part of that story. But then at a certain point, Jay and his partners decided that Jay was going to step back and he was going to figure out what he was going to do next. And of all the gin joints in all the world, he decided to take a job at Duolingo out of Pittsburgh. Like, a beat before they went IPO, he rode the lightning and did the whole IPO thing and grew a design team from Ungots to like a huge design team. And then, as recently, kind of decided like wants to catch his breath, figure out what he's doing next. We're catching him at a time where he has time for dumbass podcasts and can point things like this on these notes if he's got the time. But generally, horribly, that is like the Wikipedia of Jay Finelli as.
That was pretty good.
All right, good. All right,
That
fair.
was pretty good. You got yeah. I mean, you got the sequence right. You got the theme right. You got the vibe right. You didn't miss any big chunks.
Feels
You
like
didn't
I
miss
did.
like when I was like a shortstop for the Yankees. It's like
Oh yeah.
you didn't leave that out.
Well, I didn't get into like the whole. The other part I love about Jay, I have to admit, I love about Jay that his background was kind of advertising-y broadly before Full Stop, but he was more the account side. Like he was more of the sales, biz dev, like our side of things, Richard, that you and I would identify with more, but always loved the creative side, always loved the design side, and basically like went out and started Full Stop, not as an excuse to be the sales guy paired with a design person. Like he did that so that he could like explore being a creative director, he could explore like leading design, which was, I never had the stones to do that. I never had like, I was drawn towards that, but I never made the move to do that fully. But I think that's an interesting like part of how you decided to like start this whole thing, Jay. It was like you wanted to like get your hands on things. You had like a, you had an opinion. You had a design opinion you wanted to express. And Full Stop was like a place where you got to do that with Nate and get that whole thing off the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the time, I mean, my early career, you know, the early part of, you know, the career that's filled with companies that no one's ever heard of and most of them don't even exist anymore. I was a client services dude for like the first probably three or four jobs that I had. I was in, you know, like account services, you know, it was a little bit of biz dev, but it was mostly like, okay, we have won your business. Now I'm, you know, your person on the inside who's, you know, going to be your liaison. Not exactly a project manager, but yeah, and that sort of, I don't know. At one point in my career, I was like, yeah, I want to try to do it on my own. I was always a designer. I was always a creative. I mean, going back to like elementary school, I'm the classic case of like, didn't go to design school because I wanted to keep it like a hobby and then spend the next like 20 years, like just, desperately trying to get to design is like my day to day job. And it took me until I was about 28. To get there. And then, yeah, I've been there for the last, you know, I'm my mid 40s now. So, it was a conscious switch, but yeah, here we are.
You weren't going to tell your blue collar parents that you were going to get a design job. Like, no. Like,
I feel it's a blue collar job. Yeah, I remember my mom asked me like when I was a kid, but in like high school, she was like, yeah, why don't you go to design school or like architecture school or something like that? And I was just like, no, mom, I want to keep that as a hobby.
Right. I'm out here cashing these checks.
I think maybe that was your mom testing you.
Yeah. You think so? Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, I wonder what he's going to say, because if he says design school, I'm just going to smack him in the back of my hand.
Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up at, that's how I ended up in Pittsburgh. Went to University of Pittsburgh. Nice public school where I had a bunch of choices and switched my major a million times. And then I did end up doing none of it.
Exactly. As it should be. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
This is the role model for all aspiring generalists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm a proud generalist now can't get a job anywhere.
Unemployable. Yeah. I mean, I
thought it was unemployable when I left Cotton Bureau and was thinking about like trying to get a job. Some like as an actual employee, which would have been for me, was when I went to Duolingo, that was the first like job that I'd had in 12. It was the first time I'd interviewed for a job in like 12 years. And it was the first time that I was employed by somebody else, I think in 10 years, like almost 10 years.
Let's be honest, it probably wasn't an interview in the kind of the traditional sense. It was mostly like you knew somebody and then they asked you a bunch of questions and it probably didn't feel quite like somebody joining a company for the first time.
It was a little of column A, a little of column B. Yes, I knew someone, someone who travels in our circles, Ryan Sims, Simi, to anybody who's listening to this. Simi moved to Pittsburgh in 2018 to not to work for Duolingo. His wife's family's from Pittsburgh. So they're moving here for those reasons. But moved here, became the VP of design at Pittsburgh or at Duolingo. He and I started talking probably 9 months before I ended up at Duolingo and trying to craft the job and kind of wait for the right time. But like when it was time to interview, it was a real tech interview. I think now it's probably even a little bit more crazy.
This is a really good thing to talk about because there are a ton of people who have been employed in the sense that they have had an agency or a freelance type gig, or they've been operating in their world with their rules and their time schedules and their clients. And now for whatever reason, they don't want to do that. Maybe they've just got tired of it. Maybe the mojo's gone. Maybe they got thrown out of the partnership. I don't know. There's like a dozen reasons why, but both Joe and I have spoken to probably, I don't know, two dozen people in the last year that have gone through a midlife crisis of sorts. And the number one question that I get is, am I employable? Like, should I go and even look for a job? Is it even worth it? And the answer is, yeah. Like, first of all, it's kind of cool because you've got all this weird stuff in your head that nobody else has. Mm-hmm. And as weird as it is to you in the kind of negative sense, it's like, oh my God, what the hell is this shit doing in my head? Like for other people, it's, whoa, that's cool. That's weird enough that we might actually make it useful here.
Yeah, it's like I said, it was definitely a concern for me. And this was 5 years ago. Like, you know, am I employable by anybody after 10 years of running my own company? And I think I found the right opportunity. I think I sort of knew the right people and it was the right opportunity at the right time. I don't think I could get hired there today as a, I think I could, I'm actually in a worse position to get hired by Duolingo after 5 years of working at Duolingo than I was when I first went in there. I think companies are, especially nowadays, I think tech companies are a little bit risk averse. They want to know that you've done, you know, they're looking for the exact shape of the puzzle piece to like put in the hole that they have. And they know that they can kind of mostly go grab a piece from a different tech company and kind of snap it into theirs. And assuming there's some sort of cultural fit, that there's a decent chance that it's going to work out. At least in my experience, I have found that companies are not like super willing to take big risks, you know, with some folks. But I think my experience is limited. But I think.
So I'm going to challenge you on that, Jake, because my experience has been a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B in the sense that, yes, I think if you come in from that perspective of, well, I can do a lot of different things. So let's say you're in a conversation and somebody says, so what can you do? And you go, well, what do you want me to do? I can do a bunch of this stuff. They're just going to collapse like a flan in a cupboard. Like they don't have any way to understand how to take massive potential and mold it into something like that hole that you described. However, if you said, I noticed you've got this particular problem, like there's a thing going on here that's not working.
Yeah.
I think I can solve that problem for you. That's a completely different conversation. Then they're like, yes, sounds like you have both the ridiculous optimism and the skills to be able to solve that. But if you say, well, I've done a lot of different things, you know, just tell me what you want. Like I remember when I was interviewing at InVision, same kind of story had been working for myself for 20 years. It was like 100% sure that I was never, ever going to be employed by another person again. And then Mike Davidson and I were talking. He was like, well, I'm not sure we want to buy your company, but I think we might want you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, for what? And he was like, well, I don't know. And that was the worst part of that, was like that 6 months of going back and forth between Clark and Mike and all these other people going, what do you think I can do there? And they're like, I don't know. What do you want to do? And eventually I was just like, okay, fuck it. I'm just going to throw a dart. I was like, there's this one thing you keep talking about, and it sounds like that's like a major thorn. Like, what do you want to do about that? Because I think I can fix that. And they were like, it's all yours. Like, and they gave me what ultimately ended up being kind of like an island of misfits. All the really interesting human beings that didn't really know how to fit into the organization. They were like, give them some space to go and do this thing. But that was the moment that I realized, oh, these big companies, they don't think like I do. They don't think generally, they think specifically. And I need to be specific if I want to go and work there. So I think if anybody's listening and they're at that kind of nexus of, am I employable? I just left my agency. I just sold my agency. Or you got to be specific. You got to say, I can do this one thing really well. Or I noticed that you need this one thing. That's a good conversation to have.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, you and I both had an internal advocate, you know, me with Simi and you with Mike, you know, that kind of helped us make that case. I know for me that the need at Duolingo at the time was, I mean, the whole company was fewer than 200 people when I joined.
Right.
A little bit more than 700 now.
Right.
It needed like adults. It needed like people who, Duolingo on the whole is a very kind of early career company. A lot of people in there who are like 21, 22, 23 starting off there. And when Simi and I first got there, it was like, okay, we need like real managers. Cause we had like, you know, IC creative director types who have been there for a long time and never really had any interest in people management, managing kind of everybody. And so that's the part of like sort of the org building, hiring, you know, making sure that people had like career growth opportunities, things like that. That's kind of where the need was, at least at Duolingo at the time. That's why that's what ultimately kind of sealed my entry there, was good at that stuff.
It's, and now that it's evolved, that's probably no longer as necessary.
You'd be surprised.
It's definitely the case where, I mean, because you're Duolingo kind of time straddled the IPO, right? Like there is a thing where it's, so I think, you know, I want to give you a chance to speak to your experience in it, but there are different forcing functions when you are racing up towards IPO, and then there are different measurables and different kind of requirements post IPO that you are like evaluated by when you have shareholders and you have like a whole different like level of scrutiny or different kinds of pressure. So I think I love what Richard said too. I don't want to like gloss over that. I want to come back to the whole specificity thing. I think that's critical in so many, many, many things is to like
pick in life.
Yeah. I mean, it happens all the time. Like I've had people contact me like asking for help finding a job. It's like, well, what do you want? Like, and they think they're doing me a favor by saying like, well, you know, I don't want to be picky. Like,
yeah, I'll do anything.
Yeah. Like, but now you just gave me like an unsolvable word problem. If you said like, at least
come over and mow my lawn. Cause that's what needs.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's like, so I think like, it's also safe to say like the only job that would hire Richard or Jay to be all of the skills you were as an agency owner, a business owner, is if they hired you to run a business or run an agency. That's the only chance you get to wear all those hats and do all those things. Like, you're never going to have another job that does all of that stuff unless you have that kind of job. Like, you have to figure out what elements of that job, what parts of that job, you know, you were most excited about. I wonder, Jay, when you came into Duolingo and you were like, I mean, how many designers did you hire? How many designers did you mentor? Like, how many, and like, how young were these people? Like, what was your role like when you had to like be the den mother to like an explosively growing design team?
Yeah. So when I got there, in the middle of 2019, that was almost exactly 2 years before the company went public. All of design, like not just ICs, but like including SIMI, including program managers, and, you know, it was like 18 people. I was the 18th, I think. And when I left, design was around 120 people. Part of that included an acquisition of a small animation company in Detroit called Gunner. I think there was like 16 people in Gunner at the time, but I hired, when I left, I did the math and I think there were something like 60 people, 59 people or so involved in product design in my time at Duolingo. So everybody from, you know, Simeon down. So again, like program managers, content designers, UX researchers, managers like me, ICs, all that kind of stuff. And of those 59 people, I was involved in the hiring. I was either the hiring manager for or on the panel for like 45 of the 59. You know, and you asked about sort of, you know, the relative experience again, sort of Duolingo across the board, whether you're an engineer, whether you're a PM, whether you're a designer, has a habit of hiring very early career folks. So either like hiring them, like getting them in as interns and then converting them to full time, or just straight up university recruiting, you know, hiring people straight out of college. As a percentage, I would guess that the company is probably, geez, I don't know, like it might be like 60%, like 2/3 of the company is made up of those people. So put it this way, when I left, I was managing 9, 10 people, something like that. Yeah. And of those 9 or 10, only one of the people did not start their career at Duolingo. So
it's also a thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like everybody's like design dad, basically.
Where were they coming out of? Were they literally coming straight out of school?
Yep. So we hired a lot from like Berkeley, hired a lot from University of Washington, hired a lot from a couple designers from Duke. So
was that a strategy to get really young people and mold them?
Yeah. It was. I think for a lot of companies, I mean, I may be projecting a little bit here, but Duolingo's strategy was, it's a little bit of an island nation, kind of. You know, it's in Pittsburgh. There aren't a whole lot of other tech companies in Pittsburgh, at least certain ones that are founded here. We have, you know, we have a big Google office, a big Facebook office, and Apple, things like that. But Duolingo is, you know, with few exceptions, probably like the biggest homegrown company in Pittsburgh in a long, probably since like, you know, probably since like Heinz or, you know, like steel companies back in the, you know, 1800s. There haven't been a whole lot of other bigger companies that have come out of Pittsburgh in the last, let's say, 25 years or so. And so Duolingo kind of grew up on this tech island in a way where it could kind of do things its way, wasn't necessarily all that influenced by companies around it. It didn't borrow or give talent to other companies that were around it. If you wanted to work at Duolingo, I mean, pre-pandemic, everything was in person. So you had to move to Pittsburgh to work for Duolingo. So you really kind of had to want it and then come here and then be part of this kind of very particular like product design and product creation culture. And I think it was the company realized at some point that it was easier to sort of hire 21-year-olds and teach them this is the way, as opposed to hiring, you know, 31, 41, 51-year-olds and try to teach them out, you know, try to coach them out of the patterns that they'd built up at other companies. So yeah, I think it's a big fan of strategy.
Yeah, I like that idea. We had an apprentice program, which was inspired by that European trade model, right?
Yeah.
You come in young and you just haven't figured out what the hell you want to be even. You get a chance to touch a lot of stuff, to work with the masters.
Yep.
And
you have a lot of energy.
Yeah. Just like super, super smart, really motivated young people with like no skill.
Like yep.
Maybe they can do some stuff.
Right.
And then we filter them through a series of challenges, which are there to identify mostly character above almost anything, because you can teach somebody to push pixels. That's not the hardest job in the world. You can also teach them some of the kind of workflow and those things that have emerged as frameworks for working in product design. You can't teach them character. Like, you can't do the work that their parents should have done, right? Like just respecting working with other people, respecting the kind of the team dynamic, showing up when you need to show up, being there when your teammates need you, all that kind of stuff. So we're filtering all that. And then we're also starting to see where these people fit in that matrix of product design, product creation. Like, are you better at these things than these things? Like, do you find that you get juiced up and excited about working like this? Maybe this is a little bit more exciting for you. And that part of it not only is fun for them, because they get to find themselves on your dime. It's kind of like going to school, but also getting paid, because the apprenticeship is paid. It's not an internship, right? So about 50% of the time is school and 50% of the time is doing client work. And then you're also telling the client, look, this is an apprentice. This person's not going to get it right every single time. And we're going to discount their rate because of that. But you're also going to get way more energy because we've added this person to the team. This person's motivated to do good work. And there's something really cool about that. It definitely generates a different vibe. So I love that strategy.
Yeah. And at scale, what it does is, I mean, it affects the culture. It affects sort of what the company feels like, you know, particularly here in Pittsburgh, where most of the younger folks are concentrated, is that there's a different energy. There's a different vibe in the office every day when it's mostly, you know, 24-year-olds, as opposed to folks who are maybe closer to our age or beyond. I think, you know, and like there's good stuff with that. There's bad stuff with that. And I think a lot of people who join from industry, like I did at Duolingo, it's something that everybody has to adjust to, because I mean, the last time that most people in the world were surrounded by that many, you know, younger folks is when they were in college. And now it's like they have to work and you sort of treat a 22-year-old like, you know, like they're an equal and like they're up here. I was good at it. Some other folks had a little bit more trouble, continue to have a little bit more trouble with it at Duolingo, but it's definitely, it's interesting. Kept me young. I think it gave me sort of exposure to a lot of young people, you know, especially during the pandemic and, you know, during like, you know, George Floyd and, you know, sort of the ways that like, just like American culture has changed over the last like five or 6 years, being close to folks who are like 21, 22, like 23 has, you know, changed my perspective on the world. Changed a lot about me, I think, being exposed to younger folks like that. I think when I went in, I was like, all these kids are going to grow up because, you know, me and Simi are here. And I think if anything, I think both of us probably got a little bit younger.
Yeah, don't grow up.
I feel like a dinosaur right now. If I hadn't had those 5 years like at Duolingo, I think I'd feel like I was 7 years old right now.
So in this whole trajectory of, And there's other, you know, I don't want to like exclusively focus on Duolingo. Obviously, you've had lots of other interesting experiences. But just in this Duolingo kind of timeline, like eventually you decide that you want to step back and you want to kind of like, you know, figure out what's next or take a beat. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what was it like as you started to figure out like, you know, this might be the year that I wrap things up, or this might be the last, you know, new year I celebrate with Duolingo. Like, what was on your mind as you started to like zero in on those kinds of decisions? And what was that like when you started to like break the news to people at Duolingo and have these like, you know, design dad is going to step away kind of meetings?
Well, before you answer, Jay, I've got a corollary that goes with that. Duolingo is one of the few tech companies that's been growing really, really strongly over the last few years. Like surprisingly, like what,
it was
five
like the
times
strongest. I think it's the most successful IPO or tech IPO of 2021. Still,
yeah.
To this day.
So, with that in mind, how do you answer Joe's question?
Yeah. I think one of, and sorry for my cat is here, so if anybody hears any purring on the mic, that's it's not me.
That's you. So excited by the podcast.
Yeah, right. I'm very excited to answer this question. one of the pieces, I think one of the things, I'm going to try to kill two birds with one stone here. Or as the kids say, feed two birds with one scone, because we're trying to get violence out of the language show. Trying to get violence out of our everyday speech. I think one of the things that makes Duolingo so successful is one of the secret sauce, or part of the secret sauce, is if you ask people in tech, how big is Duolingo? If you ask anybody who knows how big tech companies generally are, go talk to somebody at Spotify or Meta or whatever and say, how big is Duolingo? They'd probably guess like 2,500 people, 3,000 people, something like that. It's like 700 something people. Back at a time when everyone in the world had still heard of Duolingo, you know, you rewind 5, 6, 7 years ago, people, you know, we all had Duolingo on our phones. Company was like 125 people. And incredible. So it's always punched above its weight class in terms of like how many people it takes to make Duolingo. And what that means in reality, at least day to day, is sort of like Duolingo in a position where other companies would have 3 people or 6 people or 20 people, Duolingo has 1 person or 2 people. And I think that creates an environment where, you know, burnout and fatigue is more prevalent, maybe, you know, because you are in a position, and especially if you're somebody who's coming from industry, you might be coming from that place where the department was 12 people doing this one thing, and now you're the one person doing it. And you're not going to get to 12 at Duolingo. You might get to 3 or 4 people doing it at Duolingo, but not a dozen or not 20. The way that shook out for both me and Simi was in like management volume and hiring volume. So there was probably two years of the 4.5 years that I was there. If you were in design, you either reported to me or Simi, and it didn't kind of matter what you did. It didn't matter what your level was. It didn't matter what team you were on or what area you were in. You reported to one of us. And so we couldn't really specialize in any one part of the company because we're managing 12, 13, 14 people across a bunch of different teams. That changed for me about halfway through my run, and I went into an area of the company. I went into monetization. So I was the design manager in monetization for the last two and a half years I was there. But it was just, it's a lot. It's a lot all the time. And I think I felt the way, you know, this is another thing we can maybe talk about, is sort of like the shift in tech from the sort of like growth at any cost model, you know, which we all sort of went through for the last like 15, 20 years, where it was like money's free. It's unlimited. Just go ask your investors for more, as long as the numbers are going in the right direction. And then you can hire another 100 people or another 1,000 people and, you know, go chase after some new business line or whatever it was, just as long as the user numbers go up. Transitioning from that world to this current world that we're in, you know, the sort of profit is mostly what matters. And there's kind of never enough profit for the shareholders. I think I sort of saw that change happen at Duolingo. And realized, you know, along with some other things, like I was going through some health stuff late last year that would kind of scare the hell out of me. And I was like, you know what?
Was that related? Do you think the health stuff was related?
I'm almost positive it was. I mean, it's an autoimmune thing. And so like, you know, autoimmune diseases don't pop up when you're an adult, unless, you know, there are sort of stressors or causes or, you know, sort of outside outside things. So that,
when, I think you got shingles on the side of your face or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was, for me, it's celiac. I can't eat gluten anymore. But you know, it's like, I mean, Joe's known me for a long time. Like, I dropped, you know, dozens of pounds over the course of like a couple of years without really trying. And I think it was, you know, I mean, and it's hard, you know, obviously the last couple of years have been stressful for all of us for reasons that exist outside of Duolingo, but, being one of two managers at a not quite hyper growth, but very fast growing company through COVID, through, you know, the sort of civil rights stuff that happened in 2020, through an IPO, and then through the changes that naturally happen with a company once it goes public. Yeah, man, it was just a lot. And, you know, I'd been pretty fortunate. You know, I mean, I joined the company a couple of years before the IPO. So, you know, I made a couple bucks and had the opportunity, just had the opportunity to take some time off and not really worry about it. And so that's kind of what this year is for me was, you know, let's take at least 6 months off.
And we'll talk about the coming 6 months or the next year or whatever, one thing I'm always curious about is, when a company's small and it's very efficient and then it somehow gets the means, maybe it's through funding or through some exponential growth or even an IPO to add more people. You said you went from 125 to 700. I think of companies like Pinterest and WhatsApp and others who've been very small when they get acquired, 20 sometimes, 30 people, 40 people.
Instagram,
and then suddenly there are thousands of people. The question I always ask is, how has my experience as the customer changed? And what I've always noticed is that it hasn't. Like, WhatsApp has not improved, even though they've added 10,000 employees. Instagram has not improved. Pinterest has not improved. In fact, we have I work with a guy who used to be one of the product guys over at Pinterest, and he's like, yeah, it just, you know, it shouldn't have grown that quickly. So how do you justify going from 125 people to 700 people? What's the logic in that?
I think at Duolingo, the thing that makes Duolingo different than those other companies is that it's not just a software problem. We are trying to teach things. And, you know, it started off with language learning. It's branched into music and math. I mean, I don't think that's the end of the line, but obviously language is the big franchise at Duolingo. Teaching language requires, I think, its own knowledge, its own specialization. That when the company first started out, it wasn't like people who knew how to teach language decided to start a startup teaching language. It was started by like mathematicians. The like, let's hire a bunch of people who know how to teach language thing like came later. You know, one of the other things that Duolingo's kind of built its brand on is this kind of irreverent animation and illustration. You know, that stuff.
It's built its brand on its brand in a lot of ways.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And, you know, it's watching the brand explode, watching like, you know, we designing like a whole cast of characters, and some of those characters have kind of gotten some following in the out there in the culture. And Duolingo's marketing is a whole other thing that we can talk about. You know, I don't know if anybody follows Duolingo on TikTok, but it's like Duolingo's the most successful corporate TikTok account there is. It takes a lot of people in certain places to make Duolingo, to make more, to create more illustration. We had a Super Bowl commercial, to put more animation in the app itself. Cause when I first got there, everything was static, very little moved. Now there almost isn't anything that doesn't move. And so like getting that specialization in house, both on the education side and on the artwork side. And then, you know, obviously scaling up all of the PMs and engineers that need to kind of go along with that stuff to build it seemed pretty natural for Duolingo to get there. I don't think there was ever a point. I mean, it's always a cultural shift when your company goes from, you know, X number to like 10X that number or 5X that number or whatever.
Right.
But I don't think there's a sense at least at Duolingo specifically, that like people look around and we're like, what the hell is everybody doing here? I think we sort of know what everybody does. Going back to my last point about Duolingo being 700 people instead of 2,500 people.
Right.
I think we look around and wonder, like, you know, we looked around for a long time and wonder, like, why aren't there more people here? Like, we should be that big. We should have more resources. Right. We should have more people in this place or that place or whatever. So the growth didn't feel unnatural at Duolingo. And also, you know, given what's happened in tech over the last 2 years, it's like being that small instead of, you know, a few thousand people means there are no layoffs.
Right.
You know, there are no big, like, we're going to lose 15% of our workforce kind of stuff happening at Duolingo. Totally. Whereas if we were a few thousand, that might have happened.
But that's been, it's interesting just to repeat the math back then, because I think there is something really interesting in this question that Richard brought up, because like when you think about like a DocuSign or somebody that goes from, you know, several hundred people to tens of thousands of people, and then there are layoffs, it's often because they're just indexed in a weird way for the way they've hired. They've built these teams and they've built all this infrastructure, and they are just, you know, there's a lot of people to lay off because there's just not a lot of, like, you can run the business differently than a business that requires tens of thousands of people. With Duolingo, it sounds like actually as you like branched off into other areas like math or music or whatever, you kind of just like 5X'd the business because you 5X'd the number of things you taught, and you 5X'd the number of then promotional stuff you had to do and marketing stuff. So like Duolingo became like a 5 times larger version of what Duolingo was at 125 people, rather than it became like a 20,000 person company with, like, you know,
yeah, it never got bloated
or in sales or whatever the hell that is. Right. It didn't like explode that way. That a lot of, to your point, the playbook for a lot of tech companies is exactly that, is, you know, reach a certain tipping point of IPOing, of growth or whatever. And this little thing, to Richard's point, that was Instagram that took 25 people to build and run is now somehow run by 7,500 people. And it's virtually the same thing. And the only difference is money. The only difference is like there's funding and there's stakeholders.
Yeah,
and
Pinterest is a really good example of that. I'm glad.
Right?
Yeah, because it seems like Pinterest hasn't changed in 15 years.
Right. It's interesting too. Like,
it's actually got worse. I think this is my point about when I asked you, like, when you're adding these people, are you moving the needle for the customer? Like, as a Duolingo user, I don't give a shit how many people work for the company, right? That's irrelevant. I don't care how many software products you use. I don't care what your workflow looks like.
Yep.
I'm really interested in my experience, though. And if that experience is remarkable enough that I recommend it to somebody else, or I continue to use it, I continue to pay for the service, then that's interesting. And I think that's that. What we noticed at InVision, I joined kind of when it was peaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also part of that kind of like, oh, here comes Figma. Oh, yeah. Fuck. Oh, shit. Oh. And then, you know, just got out at the right time. What I noticed is that there's, and this is a gross generalization, but there are people who are, if I use a party as a metaphor, there are people that are really good at starting the party. This is kind of like Joe and I think about when Joe is doing the owner camp stuff, like, hey, what if we got a bunch of people together and we sent out invitations and we found a location and we found a venue and catered it and made it happen? Like, the original organization of that is a very different mentality to the person who shows up when the party is already going and hands out cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined InVision when we had a lot of people who were there just to hand out cocktail napkins. I'm not sure why they were there. I'm not even sure they knew why they were there. They were excited. They were happy to be at the party. They were certainly the life and soul of the party. There was energy there. But I'm not sure what they knew they were doing there. And I certainly know for a fact that our customers are like, you got a lot of people, but I'm not sure how valuable they are. Like, I'm not sure if this is actually adding any. Because you say you've got X number of people on the studio team, but the product hasn't shipped.
Right. So, but here's this thing I'm desperate for InVision to do that it still doesn't do. And it's been
say 450 people on the go-to-market team.
Yeah.
That there's an imbalance there. So I'm always curious to find out if my observations work in anybody else's world, whether that's true or not, whether that, first of all, that's a silly metaphor, but like the people that start the party and are really good at getting parties going, and the people that are good at just showing up and saying, well, I'm here, and they start throwing Coke around or whatever. Like, I don't know. There are different kinds of people. And very often those people are also self-selecting, right? They're looking for the job where they don't actually have to do any work. They just have to get on the fast-moving train and say, look, I'm here, or I was here. And I'm, you know, not saying that you're one of those people, because I think like starting a company and being part of something that's growing, was you had both experiences. You created things, and you know what it's like to do that, and you also know what it's like to be part of that world, this thing's really growing quickly. So you've seen that. I'm just wondering whether mine is a myopic view or not.
I think there's something to it probably everywhere. I think there's some aspect of that. I think that's probably true everywhere. Again, kind of going back to the fact that, you know, Duolingo was relatively small at the time. And also I think had, you know, Duolingo wasn't founded in 2016. It was founded in like 2011, 2012. And so it had this probably 8-9 year run of being itself, yes, being VC backed, but still being relatively small, being fewer right. than, you know, 150 people or so. For like 8 or 9 or 10 years, where it got to kind of like really establish what the product was and what its brand was. And it responded to things that happened with the brand out in the public,
right.
And sort of brought that in and incorporated that into the brand, especially on social media. That by the time, like even if you're joining Duolingo today as an employee, there's still like a very palpable sense of what the company is and what the company wants to be, that you need to adhere to. You know, so even if you're joining now, yeah, I guess, you know, 3 years after the IPO, it's not fundamentally a different company. It's still fundamentally the same company run by the same people with the same values. They're getting better, I think, at sort of explaining what those values are internally, and communicating them to potential employees. But yeah, there's nobody just riding along at Duolingo. You know, whereas that's probably true at some other companies that are
right.
considerably bigger, or that like
that might actually be reflected in the fact that the IPO has been so successful and that it does look efficient from the outside.
Right.
Yeah.
And now hearing what you're saying about, yeah, we do ultimately burn people out, but we make sure that we get, you know, all the juice out of the squeeze.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's valued correctly. If I'm an investor and I'm looking at this company, that's the question I'm asking, is how many people are there delivering value versus how many people are there because it's exciting and fun. And
yeah,
somebody's empire building inside, there's a manager's like, well, if I had 15 people on my team, I'd be a big walking dick, you know, like,
yep.
There's a lot of that goes on as well. And
yeah, it's difficult to empire build at a place like that. That's small and efficient. Yeah. And I mean, and sort of contrary to the point about burnout, is that folks stay at Duolingo forever. You know, the average tenure at Duolingo is very long. So it's more like 4 or 5 years than it is like 1 or 2 years in the rest of tech, where people are, you know, especially if you're out in the valley and you're bouncing between different companies every 18 months. Very, very, very little of that happens at Duolingo. People come and they stay forever.
I love that.
Feels like Pittsburgh's a big part of this. It feels, I mean, this is like some bullshit amateur sociology on my part, but I wonder how much, you know, maturity Duolingo was able to achieve kind of off the radar in Pittsburgh rather than in Silicon Valley to like focus on the product. And, you know, if the same company was in Palo Alto, maybe this whole thing is accelerated by 5 years and it happens at a much earlier stage than, you know, Duolingo had this, like, you know, kind of like under the radar 8-9 year run where it kind of got shit right and figured stuff out and, you know, wasn't anybody's investment darling at that point yet. Right. Like didn't look like that to people, but was just building a thing. And then by the time all this energy gets poured in, and I've, Jay, you've used this term and I'm going to steal it, but like when there's like a wartime consigliere kind of, you know, vibe to things, when you're in that kind of like, you know, pre-IPO, through IPO, post-IPO kind of craziness, like, you know, the company was more established and the culture was more established and been kind of doing its thing longer and was then better able to weather the fucking craziness of all that. Like, I can't even, like, I got waves of this from you. I got waves of this from, I think, the real, you know, reason for Duolingo's success, we would all agree, is Mary Van Ochtrop. It's MVO.
That's right.
That's the
MVO.
She's the head of content.
She was just over here like last week. She's over at the house like a week or two ago. Yeah.
She is one of my best friend, Raul Anders, who used to do Clutch with me and is still like one of my best friends. It's his wife, and she is a content strategist who was always amazing and did freelance work at HappyCog. And then she, you know, had her whole career and I think knew Cine from Ardio, right?
Yep.
The best. Like, I think that's like, if that's what you have in common with people is you both worked at RDO, then I love you, because RDO was the best. And I want to pour one out for RDO every day.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, totally, totally. But
the Swedish music streaming service that lost.
Exactly, exactly. And what was inevitable, the Swedish music streaming wars that everyone had always kind of knew were going to come. RDO was the one that lost. Yeah. That's right. But in that kind, like, so when you imagine or you think back on your time at Duolingo, do you think of yourself as like someone that's built for like wartime consigliere kind of mode? Do you see yourself as somebody who's more like, I think about it too, in sports analogies, when general managers are successful building sports teams, I see you wearing your Spurs.
Mm-hmm.
Sweatshirt, good on you.
Come on, Spurs.
Like, there are people that are good at like building a team from crap to good. And then there are people that are good at like building sustained success with teams, which is really, really, really hard. That's like back to the hard part is like, how do you keep a successful team successful? Because going from 0 to 90 is easier than going from 90 to 100. So in your experience, as you look back on everything that you kind of dealt with there, do you feel like drawn towards the opportunity and chaos of the wartime consigliere part of it? Do you see yourself more drawn towards like a more kind of like mentory kind of and not as dynamic kind of scenario? Like what parts of it do you feel like you missed the most when you think back to like that run?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I am not a wartime consigliere at all. I'm more of a peacetime consigliere. I feel like I am like vibes, not numbers.
Okay.
As a manager, and to go back to the sports metaphor, I've sort of tried to put my time at Duolingo into a lot of different metaphorical frameworks. And I feel like the thing that makes the most sense to me is that, you know, going back to like a football metaphor here, like, Duolingo was not playing at the top flight of our level of football when I joined the company. We were in like maybe the second division or so. And I was part of the management team that got us promoted to the top flight.
Okay.
But ultimately I'm not the kind of manager that's going to keep us at the top flight or like win the top league.
That's a whole different animal.
That's a whole different animal. And you mentioned, you know, going from 80 to 90 or going to 90 to 100. I think at the top flight, it's not really about going from 90 to 100. It's about staying at 100. It's about going at 100 all the time and trying to find those little inefficiencies and those little management tweaks and how to motivate people and how to, like, you know, get the right OKRs on the list in order to keep the car going 100 miles an hour and not lifting and not hitting the brakes and not like taking a break. And that's not the kind of manager I am. Are those people out there.
It's Le Mans, not
Formula One. Exactly. Yeah.
We're just going to keep metaphoring this.
I can go into motorsports metaphors too. That's fine. I'm happy to do that.
If you come on this podcast and you're not ready to make some shit abstract and get metaphorical, then stay the hell home.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's what this is for. Well, you're talking to the wrong three people at the moment.
I want to know what you're going to do to find your peace, you find your center again. What does the next chapter look like?
Well, part of it is a bunch of time off. And I'm sort of like dividing this time into a couple different phases. I would say, I guess I'm at sort of the beginning of the second phase. Like phase one was like total isolation. you know, stay Big home fan. For 2 months. Don't really talk to anybody. Work out. Hang out with my cat. Make some food. You know, try to wait out the last few months of Pittsburgh winter. Phase two is honestly just doing stuff like this, like having conversations with folks, reconnecting with people who I haven't talked to in a while, you know, going and getting coffee with some friends locally just to see some creative friends who I haven't really been connected with. I think that's another thing that sort of tech does to you is it sort of, it's easy to get lost inside. It's easy to like, you know, you work at an InVision, you work at a Duolingo, and it's like your entire world is Duolingo for as long as you're there. And then it's like you lose track of people who you used to talk to all the time. And you know, it's like I know all of the same people that you two know for the most part, and I haven't talked to any of them in like 6 years. Because I've just been, you know, hiring people at Duolingo for, you know, since 2019. So phase two is like sort of like personal reconnection. Like, let's connect with people who I know are doing some things and sort of see what's out there. At some point, I think I'll probably start something small. I don't know exactly what it's going to be. And right now, the list is pretty big. It's sort of everything from, yeah, start another design studio to urban mushroom farm. I don't know. Like
that's better.
Yeah. You know, like restaurant, resale location, buy a couple apartment buildings and just be a, you know, capitalist pig for the rest. I don't know. Like there's a bunch of options out there right now for what's next.
Yeah, I mean, and you can do all of those, right? It's just
exactly. They're not mutually exclusive. I could be a mushroom farmer and a capitalist pig.
Yeah, you have to buy the building, put your tenants inside your mushrooms, in the basement.
The basement, yep. Right. On top of the basement.
Yeah. And then you've got your restaurant on the roof deck where you serve the mushrooms.
And right. So and much time for podcasting during all of that. And
it's sick. Yeah, I can't wait.
And then invite all your friends over so you can reconnect.
Yeah. So, but no, I mean, to be honestly, it's like my time right now is, you know, there's a couple of soccer games later today that I want to watch.
Yeah. So like, I had some time off a couple of years ago and I did exactly what you just described. I went through this kind of divergent phase where I was like, I'm just going to entertain many, many things. But the key healing ingredient was actually getting to go and spend time with people. So we planned both domestic and international travel that was just intended on reconnecting with people. And so it just mm-hmm. so happens that a lot of the nice people in my life live in really cool places. So it wasn't that difficult to convince me, but it was like, well, let's go to Lisbon, let's go to Barcelona, let's go to London, mm-hmm. let's go to all these places and reconnecting with friends and hanging out there, not just being a tourist, but actually like staying long enough that you need to actually go and get your hair cut at a local barbershop or, you know, buy groceries and things like that. That was the best thing. And I recommend maybe doing that every 10 years so that you reconsolidate those meaningful relationships that you have.
Cotton Bureau and Full Stop and Pixel Workers was built almost entirely on really, especially Cotton Bureau was built entirely on relationships. And I sort of took that muscle and brought it internally to Duolingo to start managing people. And again, especially kind of younger career people and building relationships inside. And it's just sort of like exploring that part of my professional identity inside a company. But that meant sort of completely abandoning it like externally. Now it's sort of like, all right, who am I now? Who do I want to be next? Like, what do I want to be next? You know, because for people like us, I think we, especially for those of us who have started our own company, like that, your work becomes part of your identity a lot more easily, both in this industry and when you're somebody who has our background. And I got to figure out, like, is that, you know, I don't know, is that something I want? Is that something I want to go deeper back into? Or is that something that I want to try to peel away from?
What I hear you saying is that we should all get together.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Why aren't we doing this in person? Richard, where are you? Where are you right now?
I'm driving distance. I'm in Boston.
All right. Yeah, we'll go to Joe's house. I'll meet you there like three in the afternoon.
One of the things that I did was I went to I'm a Liverpool fan. I'm sorry to tell you, but
I like Liverpool enough. At least you're not Arsenal.
I went to Anfield to watch a game, and it just so happened to be the game they played. Man United and beat them 7-0.
No way! And you were at the 7. Wow! All right.
Yeah, and so that's the kind of thing where you just make excuses to you say like, listen, we're all going to go. We're going to do this thing because there's nothing quite like a Premier League game or a Formula One race. There's like those are the big sports.
It was nice being friends with both of you as long as you would tolerate me so you can just be best friends now and leave me in the
dust. Yeah, now that we're both talking about F1. And
two of the magic words, EPL and Formula One. Like this is like, that's like two-thirds of the Jay Finelli pie. Right,
this podcast just got an hour longer.
Holy shit. That's episode two of this whole thing.
Well, I learned this lesson from a friend of mine who he's a VC and he runs these events and he makes sure that the events happen around things like that. So he would take us to the Circuit de Catalunya and put us in the paddock, like pre-event or like if it was a training week or something like that, or Monaco or, and it would just be like, oh, yeah, of course I'm coming. And he's like, well, it's going to cost money. I'm like, I don't care.
Right.
Like I'll sell my children. Like this is the kind of thing that want to hang around with the cool people.
That's part of it's part of what my wife and I talk about. My wife Michelle, who also works at Duolingo, we've worked together in the past. If the kind of people who actually listen to this podcast listen to it, I don't know, 30%, 40% of them know Michelle too. Yeah. We're thinking about, like, when we talk about what's next for us, it's almost always like a joint business thing. Mm. So like, you know, she'll stay another couple of years at Duolingo, and then, you know, if this thing is a success, like she'll leave, right, and we'll run it together. But part of our sort of initial like ideation here is like, yeah, like how do we do something that either like allows us the lifestyle room to go enjoy these things that we like, or like is maybe a part of it? You know, how do we get involved with F1? How do we get involved 100%. with European football, something like that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Ooh, we should talk. All right. Offline. We're not going to talk about this on the podcast.
Well, maybe it's another podcast.
So everybody's favorite iOS developer, Anthony Colangelo, friend of the podcast, friend of Jay Finelli and myself, who was in that model, a 20-year-old kid who came in and worked at Happy Cop, was exactly the apprentice model. It was exactly like what we talked about. Anthony and I have an idea for a Tour de France related iOS app that we've been kicking around, and maybe you two ding dongs are the two pieces we've been searching for. Because
I want to point out something, and this is a really, really important consideration right now. Formula One they never got to the point where they negotiated the rights of the event into the holding body. So let me explain that. So the way the Premier League is set up is that the club has all the rights to all the things, right? The content, the merchandise, everything. Mm. So when you go to Anfield, that is owned by Liverpool. That experience top to tail is owned by Liverpool. Go online, they own it. Everything is owned. Formula One doesn't have that.
Mm.
In its Eccleston era, Formula One didn't think about IP. And so a lot of what you're seeing right now, like that Netflix stuff,
yep,
that's an over-the-top experience that looks and feels a lot like Premier League.
Yeah, it does.
But it's completely separate.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no unifying platform that says, hey, if you're an F1 fan, here's how to enjoy that F1 experience. There's no independent version of that. Mm. There are all these like slices that are like a broken up slices. There's like a McLaren club and obviously the Ferrari club has been around for a long time, but that also has different kind of connections. But there's no unifying Formula One experience where the content and all that stuff is delivered to you in the way that you want to, in the same way that Premier League is. It's strange.
Yeah, it's an interesting sport to follow. Especially, I mean, you mentioned Bernie Eccleston, like especially in the Liberty Media age of, you know, Liberty Media is the company that owns F1. We're getting deep into the weeds here, guys. They just bought MotoGP as well. They own the Atlanta Braves. But yeah, they're the ones that have like, the reason, Joe, you know about Formula One now.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Is because of Liberty Media.
Yeah. 100%.
And that was a media play, but there's no data play. There's no I don't know who goes to what event. I don't know that somebody called Jay Finelli went to Monaco to watch that event and bought this merchandise. That stuff is completely unresolved. There are CIOs for each of the different teams. But there's no CIO. Like when I was at the MIT CIO conference, I sat next to the guy who's the CIO of NASCAR. So there's NASCAR has NASCAR, and then the teams fit into that from a data play point of view. But there's no data play for F1 where like each person experiences it through the lens of like, oh, well, they came to this event, they bought this merchandise.
Right.
They should be going to this next event because, you know, they're local to Austin or whatever their connection. That stuff is like a mystery right now.
That's interesting. Because like in Major League Baseball, Major League Baseball owns all the content. The teams don't own the content. The teams don't own the video of games, broadcast. Like they don't own any of that stuff. So that is all owned by a division of Major League Baseball called, like, I think it's Major League Baseball Media or something, MBLM.
Yeah.
And so like teams are really handcuffed with what they can do because they can't do stuff without content, without the mothership's kind of say so and investment. Whereas like the NFL, it's insanely have and have not. because the NFL owns next to nothing. The Cowboys own everything. The Seahawks own everything. And then, so there are like teams that have massively more robust infrastructure than the team right next to them, because it's not the ownership of all of the infrastructure is not managed the same way. It's interesting. I mean, but especially
I think given that Jay's got all this time, what he should do is invite us to meet him in an interesting place like Azerbaijan or Singapore or something like that.
We're looking for a race to go to this year. We haven't gone. We have no plans.
Azerbaijan is the cheapest. If you don't want to spend any money, Monaco is, I think, the most expensive.
Went to Monaco a couple of years ago.
We did, so we did Barcelona, which was fantastic because it's a great location because you can be doing other things as well.
Right. I've always wanted to go one within Austin for that reason.
Like, well, Austin's cool, but it's also like, I've been to Austin 100 times. Like,
yeah,
I want to go somewhere and experience that place as well.
Yeah. Also, you're sitting outside. It's like 110 degrees, like just in the sun in Austin.
You're on the surface of the sun. No.
Yep. Legit.
All right. Listen, we're going over our time. People have,
yes, we have
meetings and commitments and lives and stuff.
That's like, right.
Eclipse, we're not all on the, you know, self-discovery journey like Jay is. I mean, come on.
I am a very privileged boy to be able to. I want to say that. I want to say that out loud while we're talking.
I feel like this is also
recurring. You've earned it, buddy. You've earned it.
John Lax had to make the same disclaimer, like I almost killed myself working on this thing for 6 years. I'm sorry. I'm taking a break.
Yeah.
It's okay that maybe you worked a lot harder than the average bear for this amount of time, and you just need to like take a breath. That's okay. Like, you don't have to. I appreciate where it comes from, and I feel solidarity with the desire to kind of like acknowledge your privilege and your opportunity. 100%. At the same time, from the cheap seats, I just want to say to you and John and these other folks, like, you're allowed to take a fucking breath because you've earned it, and that's okay too. And you're in this. This came up with Craig, Richard. It's interesting. Jay is kind of describing a similar like 5 to 7 year cycle of like, you know, and now I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. In 5 to 7 years, and I'm going to figure out what to do.
It's worth mentioning that, because one of the things that we talked about was, I've also had this idea in my mind where you should reverse your life, right? So you should be retired first and then work.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got the time and energy to do stupid things, that's when you should be learning how to, you know, paraglide and ski and whatnot. Right. Not when you're 70 and your knees are given out. But Craig came up with even a better version. He's like, do that. Take like years off at the beginning and you know, fuck around and find out.
Right.
But then every, say, whatever, I can't remember what he said, like 6, 7, 8 years, take a retirement, like have thin slices of a retirement embedded in your life.
So retire a little bit at a time.
Yeah, so that you're never really retired, because, I mean, as we know, the data says when you retire, you're about 6 years away from death, right? That's like, you basically start dying as soon as you retire. Yeah. So these ideas of having these thin slices of a retirement makes so much more sense.
I
wish I could have done this more frequently. I mean, the last time I took off was, I only took about 2 months off between Cotton Bureau and Duolingo. I can't remember the last time I had time off before that. So yeah, it's been, you know,
be fair too,
15 years or so.
Yeah, and in that 2 months was a different kind of 2 months. Like that was not yes, you were not working for 2 months, but you were not in the same headspace for those 2 months that you're in now, where you were approaching it very differently.
Yes. That was a very different kind of time off. And that was, that was like preparation for, all right, I'm going to go into something else now. I'm going to go do something differently. You know, this is like,
on that note, I'm leaving for Europe this afternoon.
Oh.
To take a small, very small sliver.
Yes.
Where are you headed?
And London, Mallorca, Barcelona.
Love that. I was in Barcelona, Rome, and Venice last year. We're going to London next week. Going for long weekend.
Weather's fantastic. It's looking great. Thank you, global warming. That's the idea. It's sliver, a sliver, a sliver. Keep doing it.
Yeah. You know, it's starting to get warmer here. We have a nice deck out in the back of our house, like put the plants out. It's like, that's, you know, that's when the real break happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And somebody, I like the way somebody put this the other day. It was like somebody, the eclipse was like basically like turning the lights off and turning them back on again. Like you have to like, we're going to start spring, turn the lights off, turn them back on again. Now it's springtime. Like, I totally, because yesterday it was like 61 and it felt like, you know, Panama City spring break here. It was like, I want to go out and, you know, take half my clothes off because it feels 61 degrees. Like, holy shit, this is, you know, the middle of summer all of a sudden. Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. We're going to get together. We're going to do something fun. Yes. Joe's going to organize it because he's got nothing better to do.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right. See you in Azerbaijan.